Hello, this is State Senator Leticia Vandepute wishing you and your family a safe and happy 4th of July. Today we also remember those who serve us in harm's way. Welcome to the Texas Tribune, where these amazing journalists will try to shrink Texas government into a 30-minute segment. And now for today's show.
Thank you, Senator. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the first week of July. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Did you get the reference to the shrinking government?
I don't get references, Reeve.
I believe it's to a quote, a famous quote of hers that says that Texas is going to shrink government until it fits in a woman's uterus.
Okay.
There you have it.
Scintillating.
It is scintillating.
Yeah. Also joining us is...
How is that our fault?
I want to give Kate a high five for using scintillating in a sentence. That was good.
Yeah, there are certain words sprinkled throughout the Tribcast that we've been challenged to fit into it. Uterus was not one of them.
And you were about to introduce Kate.
Was I?
Yeah.
I was going to introduce you.
I'm here. Now introduce
Kate. Ross Ramsey is here.
Hi.
You know that if you introduce Kate first, be heresy. That's another one of the words.
It is a drinking game.
Yeah. If Kate hadn't been off having her tryst, then she would have been here introduced.
And the duck comes down.
Okay, we're done.
Whoa.
Here. Okay.
This is really...
All right, so we've hit our list now. We've crossed those off. Kate Galbraith, the reporter, is also here.
Hello, Reed.
Kate Galbraith, the reporter.
That's how she was introduced. Who covers all those upbeat topics like we have no water and we have no energy.
Right.
And we have no electricity.
And it's way too hot.
And it's way too hot.
It sounds like a description of the podcast.
Way too hot. Yes. Clearly you've seen our new reviews on iTunes since we're back up there.
Are there reviews already?
Well, there were already a number of reviews.
Are they negative?
No.
Okay, good.
But they will be after this one, I think. Let's talk about... So, obviously, we're not breaking any news here, obviously. But the healthcare decision came down last weekend. Last week. Before the weekend.
Last Thursday, post-podcast.
And the Texans had something to say about it. I believe Rick Perry's quote about it was great. He said that it was a frontal assault?
On
liberty or freedom or both?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to take pretty straight, non-policy, partisan terms for, you know, the next few months, all the way through November. It's going to be about, you know, we're going to hear it called the biggest tax increase in history. It's not, in fact. It's not even the biggest tax increase in the last three presidencies. And we're not going to be talking about policy, I don't think, for a while. The Democrats have never really defended this thing, which is sort of baffling, and the Republicans have... You know, this is still like in the first line of everybody's fundraising letter and the first line of everybody's speech. And
there's a danger, though, in the Republicans attacking this law now that it's constitutional, because you have elements of it that are popular even within their base. The idea that you're going to continue to insure 26-year-olds in households. Parents will be able to keep their kids on through 26, or the pre-existing conditions. You know, the fact that that's no longer a disqualifier. Those are things that are popular across party lines. And the danger, I mean, the benefit to attacking it in advance of a decision was that you associated Obama with some kind of unconstitutional power grab. That's now been taken off the table. The power grab was done by John Roberts, according to these same people now. But Obama is essentially in the clear as far as that part of it goes. And then if the Republicans have to argue the particulars of it, it's harder for them to argue against many of these things that I've named, which are popular not just with Democrats but with their own base.
Right. And you get into this problem, you know, as a matter of policy, if you keep these items, each of these items costs money, and now you're responsible for some of the costs, and how are you going to pay for it? And we start the whole fight all over again. You know, the Republicans, it's been interesting watching the last week, especially from Texas, where, you know, overwhelmingly the political world in Texas seems to be against this thing. But they get into this position pretty quickly, I think, if they win, that they have to say, there's two things here. They would rather have won, and they're calling the loss a win. You know, if you notice this flip, that's sort of like, well, the long-term thing is that this is a win because of the way Roberts wrote the decision.
Right. And, oh, by the way, we can opt out of expanding Medicaid. And that's going to be our stand against this, as Florida and, I gather, South Carolina and other governors of those states have done. Our governor is saying, and our health infrastructure at the state level is saying, we're not going to expand Medicaid.
Right, right. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how it filters out. You know, the not expanding Medicaid thing is sort of an echo of the unemployment insurance thing that Rick Perry did last time, you know, where the government put $555 million out for unemployment insurance if the states wanted to take it and if they would meet certain criteria. And he said, no, we're not taking those strings. We're not taking that money. So here we are with that again. And in fact, the Supreme Court decision did pave the way for them not to take the money. But I have a feeling that we're not going to have a real, genuine policy conversation about this thing until after the elections. I think it's just going to be a rhetorical political device until November, till the second week of November.
Well, on Thursday, I did have coffee with a couple of Republican consultants sort of right after the decision came out. They were acting like this just locked up the November election for them. And, you know, now Romney was going to raise tons of money. It would be a super easy selling point. And then yesterday, I think, I came in the lobby of our building and CNN was on, which is, I think, their new plan to up their ratings. Just get everyone as they walk in the lobby. Right. And they were showing a poll that showed the enthusiasm for the November elections back in March and post-healthcare decision, and there had been a huge swing in favor of the Democrats from a sort of a six-point deficit to a nine-point lead or something like that.
Well, the interesting thing here is the problem Romney faces in attacking this is that he's ultimately attacking something that's A, constitutional, and B, is similar
his thing
to what he did himself. And, you know, the words of Rick Santorum saying that Romney is the absolute worst person who could be nominated to challenge Obama on healthcare in the fall are ringing in my ears now. Because what does Romney say? Well, it's constitutional, but we still don't like it. But it's exactly or similar to what you put into effect in Massachusetts.
I also tend to wonder if there might be some element of voter fatigue with this, you know, sort of let's take down healthcare thing. Because, I mean, we kind of built it into the crescendo from the Supreme Court decision. And then there's, you know, kind of a lull. And then we've got to build back up to November. And can we have kind of, can we sustain two peaks of, you know, fury at healthcare? I mean, we'll see.
And other things are going to, frankly, replace the level of enthusiasm for the fight over this issue. Other things will step into the breach, you know.
Right.
There are a lot of other issues between now and November that are going to come up. And since the Supreme Court has effectively decided this issue as a national issue, it's time for other things.
Well, it does take it off the table.
Doesn't it? And yeah. Frankly, the Romney folks want to just talk about the economy.
Right.
And I know they want to talk about the healthcare decision as somehow being tied to the economy, right, through this question of a tax or whatever else. But the reality is they're better off talking about jobs, not healthcare.
Well, and I think they just want to get back to the Reagan question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And you know, I think that's where their focus has been and probably will be.
And we have a jobs report coming out on Friday that could be, you know, more bad news as the last jobs report was for the president, in which case the conversation may pivot completely away from health care and back right on to Romney's strong ground.
So. I do think that this potentially for Republicans in Texas, you know, if you're at a down ballot Republican in Texas, this could be relatively good news because Texas Republicans are mad enough about Obama and now about Obamacare and all of this stuff that, you know, some consultants, I talked to Brian Epstein in Fort Worth, I talked to a couple of other people this week working on something else and talking about turnout, and some of them said, you know, people are mad enough at Obama that they will drive turnout. And if they drive turnout at the top of the ticket or in the middle of the ticket, you know, House members may benefit from that. You may get another sweep in the Republicans into the House like you got in 2010.
Meanwhile, John Roberts is in Malta.
Well, right. Isn't that where you'd be, about as far away from the center of this as you can be?
Did you hear this line? He was in, what was it, Kate? He was in front of a group of lawyers and they said,
yeah, he's like, I'm going to a fortressed island, literally.
But one person who can't escape to a fortress island, oh, I guess he could if he wanted to, but just I believe he's still in the state, is Greg Abbott. How big of a loss was this for him?
You know, he had three losses this last week, but seemed in a perfectly good mood about it.
They may have been losses technically.
Right.
But theoretically.
He's the Teflon Attorney General as far as that goes. I don't think anybody is associating this as a real negative. Oh, now Abbott's progress toward the governor's office
right.
or Abbott's political trajectory has now been somehow derailed. I don't think anybody sees this as Abbott's doing or Abbott's mistake.
He's fighting the fight, I guess.
And he's one of many attorneys general who was fighting against Obamacare, and he and they all were turned back by the court.
Right.
And I can't see how tell me what the negative fallback is.
He just had a bad week in terms of multiple decisions and things not going his way.
Right, the greenhouse gas decision, for example.
The greenhouse gas decision, the immigration decision, and this one. Next week he goes into the voter ID thing, so I guess they can roll this forward. Next week they start the voter ID case in D.C. Circuit Court, right? And this is the case basically saying whether or not Texas's voter ID law is constitutional and whether or not, I guess the immediate case is whether or not it could be used in November. People have to present photo IDs or not. So I guess he moves on to his next fight. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look like he got hurt. It is interesting that he got, smacked down three times with a bunch of other people, but smacked down just the same and no apparent effect.
Well, I mean, so much of his identity is or has become sort of this idea that he just sues the federal government every day. And, he mentioned it at the...
What was that great line? I get up, I go to work, I sue the federal government, I go home.
Yeah, something like that.
My job's not that hard.
Or he always is joking about it on Twitter.
Yep.
And, just if you're never successful in it.
But you could argue, but there's two ways to look at it. One is you're not successful. The other thing is, every time the federal government prevails in one of these things, Abbott and Perry and others are more resolute and they have a demon to battle with.
Right.
And I actually think this is why I think ultimately the healthcare law is probably more of a net plus than a net minus for Romney, the decision. They've got a bogeyman. And they've got someone to rail against, whether it's rational or irrational, whether it's logical or illogical. And I think from Abbott's perspective, the federal government is still the bad guy. And so the fact that this was, that they affirmed the constitutionality of the mandate and of the other parts of the law is probably good for Abbott because Abbott's got somebody to be mad at. Even if it's bad for Texas in the short term, in Abbott's mind, it's probably good for Abbott politically. Would you agree?
Yeah, probably so.
Of course, the boogeyman for Kate is always the drought.
Thank you, Reed.
That's what Reed calls a transition. That's,
Can't Abbott just sue the clouds?
Clouds, we need rain.
Tomorrow is the 4th. This will go up on the 4th. So today is the 4th. If those of us that are going swimming to celebrate our independence, will this be our last chance to do so in the great state of Texas?
Well, Reed, the lakes are 50% full that supply Austin. So right. Who knows?
Only up to your belly button.
Yeah, but no, I mean, the drought is, people have forgotten about it a little bit because it rained all spring and now it's back. I mean, there are drought conditions over most of the state and we're using a lot of water. I mean, there was just news this week that the Ogallala Aquifer, measured it. Ogallala. I know you like hearing me say that. They measured it over the winter in some monitoring wells and in a 16-county part of the panhandle. It's dropped the most since 25 years ago. So it's pretty serious. I mean, basically, the farmers are just pumping more water as the rains don't come. So it's a big deal.
I believe you wrote in Texas Monthly that it's probably the biggest threat to the state's economy, something along those lines.
Something along those lines, yes.
That was probably in the headline, which those editors wrote without reading the story.
Right.
Yeah, I have a little bit of experience with that.
What is the... everything will just fall apart if we don't have any water. Right?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, how do they catch this up? It's like something... It's like all of the solutions are things you should have done or we should have done 15 years ago.
And we did do after, past droughts. I mean, we built a ton of reservoirs in the 1960s after the 1950s drought. So the big question is, are we going to do that again? Are we going to build desal plants? Are we going to learn to conserve water,
Outlaw St. Augustine grass, right?
Right.
I like the idea of taking non-potable water and doing whatever kind of work on it that has to happen to make it usable, if not drinkable. There are places where they're taking essentially sewage or other...
Or brackish water.
Right, brackish water.
When you say you like the idea, do you mean, is that one of those ideas that you would like to experience yourself?
Personally, I wouldn't. But my point is that we're running out of options. And so if gross, disgusting water rehabilitated so that it can be used is our only option, then that's our only option. And not having water is not an option. And so my point is that whatever technology can be applied to solve this problem, I think it's a good thing. And there are places where, as you say, in Midland and elsewhere, where they're doing this. But
and indeed, I mean, the joke is that sort of Houston drinks Dallas's sewage water, essentially, because it just comes down the Trinity River.
Dallas's revenge.
Just like the sound of that, actually.
Is that a joke or is that just a fact?
It's a joke fact.
It's a jacked. It's a folk.
So it's not really a novel thing then.
I mean, it's just
Houston's been doing it for years.
Gradations of something and different sort of ways of doing things, but yes, I mean basically what
sound you heard is all of Houston vomiting at the sound of this podcast.
All right. But yes, we have a lot of brackish water, which means sort of salty water underneath us. We've got a lot of sewage water, and
which means what?
You can use your imagination, and we have a lot of opportunities to conserve water and so on. So we can also try building new reservoirs, but those are big and expensive and difficult to permit.
Is it just the drought, or is someone to blame for the Ogallala aquifer dropping as much as it has?
Well, I mean, the farmers are pumping, you know, considerable amounts of water. It's the breadbasket of America, and we're part of it. And, you know, it's going to keep going down. I mean, the farmers recognize it, and they're trying to do more water efficient technologies, but those are expensive, and, you know, a lot of people say they're not doing enough, et cetera, et cetera. And then the farmers point the fingers at the cities, and they're like, well, you guys are watering your lawns, you know, so what excuse do you have for that? What use is grass anyway? So it's a very it's a very complicated conversation.
But the business proposition here is that water gradually becomes more expensive and some of the stuff gets crowded out, right? So eventually you get to a point where you say, well, are we going to grow cotton, or are we going to grow St. Augustine?
Right, absolutely. And that involves raising water rates, which nobody is happy about, you know, arguably, particularly in a state like this where, you know, there's tremendous scrutiny of government,
right,
government spending. And so, you know, I mean, Midland jacked up its water rates by, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 times on top users. I mean, it's tremendous change for people who use a lot of water. And some people are going to be kind of water inflexible and just, or price inelastic, I think was the word I was looking for.
But this is like the first week of economics in college. It's like scarcity drives prices up, right? And, you know, I mean, eventually you get to a point where the Midlands and the Odessas are no different. You know, the Dallases and the Houstons are just like the Midlands and the Odessas. They weren't the nerve ending. You know, they weren't in the driest part of the state, so they weren't the first to feel it.
Right. We just have to recognize that there's scarcity in the future going forward as, you know, our population grows and our climate potentially has these big swings.
Well, and the inevitability of the population growth is something that we are going to have to confront, and we're not confronting it in a lot of other subject areas as well: transportation, public education. Water may be the most pressing of these, immediately pressing.
Well, there's two things here. One of them, the business lobby, if you just sort of watch them as an indicator of issues, is ahead of the politicians in talking about long-term things like
water,
electricity, you know, infrastructure.
Workforce development by way of education.
Right. You know, roads, all of that kind of stuff. And the other thing that's sort of interesting is that in our polling, the MIPS part of our polling, the most important problems part of our polling, when you ask Texans what the most important national problems are, they still say economy, jobs, unemployment, immigration, you know, the economic stuff. But on the state level, they're coming, you know, some of these other issues are starting to bubble up to where they're talking about them as most important problems facing the state. And as the economy, if the economy recedes as an issue to some extent, if the economy improves, then some of these come up.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look at the power grid. That's really very under strain sort of now as we get this hot weather. And what about in, you know, 2 years when our population has grown a little more, when they build all these new petrochemical plants that are going, you know, being announced practically every week on the coast? I mean, these are all kind of resource constraint issues that we're going to face with growth.
But isn't El Paso sort of the model for this? I mean, it's a fast-growing city in a very dry area, and they seem to be making it work to some extent. I guess they paid everyone to xeriscape their lawns. So
yes.
You don't have any kids out there playing football on their lawns.
I mean, they've been fining people for years. If you overspray your lawn, you know.
Right, they actually have permanent restrictions.
They write you a ticket, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They've done a lot of things.
Is that a tax or is that a penalty, Ross?
It's a penalty. They just charge you. You can overspray if you want to. You can water the street, but it's $250. I mean, they come by and write you a traffic ticket.
So how is that different exactly than health care? If you choose not to get health insurance, you pay your penalty. It's not a tax. It's a penalty.
Well, nobody has to come water your lawn for you if you can't pay for it.
Because if I don't use health care, then I'm essentially get it free, in the emergency, I'm free riding or right, free loading.
You're going to get it in the emergency room. It's going to be uncompensated care.
Can't we build into this that if you don't choose to have health insurance, then the penalty is you have to have...
You have to go water people's lawns.
Or you got
to
be a Christian Scientist or something like that. You know, no medicine for you.
Well, his name is Evan Smith.
See how you like it. Yeah.
You mentioned workforce development through education.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's, you know, when you're dealing with these issues with the sort of like, we need to do something before it's too late kind of issues, it's also interesting to see, like, you could do something wrong, right? I mean, Tom Pockin of the Workforce Commission and Raymond Paredes of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board had sort of an interesting little tiff at a hearing earlier this week or last week?
I think it was late recently. Last week. About accountability and standardized testing.
It was on the day that the Obamacare decision came
out. It was about, you know, Pockin's been saying, look, we need more sort of skilled people, and so we need more, you know, sort of career and technology education. And Paredes was like, we need more of all education. You can't just say, oh, we just need to make more welders and technicians. We need more sort of high-level scientists and more right. high-level engineers. So you can't, in your effort to boost our workforce in this one area, you can't do that to the detriment of our workforce in these other areas.
Is Pockin arguing that it's a binary choice, A or B, or is he acknowledging it's both and? Because it is both and, obviously.
He's arguing that we need to be focused more on these sort of skilled... I mean, we need more auto shops and high schools and things. And Paredes was saying, I mean, he was saying that's the wrong way to frame it. We just need more of everything, essentially.
Right. They've got this fundamental question that nobody really wants to answer because it's dangerous politically. But there's a policy question on, do you send everybody to college or not? If you do send them to college, do you send them to 4-year? Do you send them to 2-year? Do you track them toward blue-collar jobs, toward white-collar jobs? I mean, you got to answer all those questions at some point.
You remember Rick Santorum's words during the campaign, you know, how Barack Obama's a snob, everybody right. has to go to college. Well, the fact is, it's okay to say that people should continue their education after high school, but we should give them a menu of options. I'm not certain that the president was saying everybody has to go to Harvard.
Right.
But
right.
the reality is people should look at continuing their education past high school as a likely or logical goal. And it may mean that they go to technical school, or it may mean they go to community college. It also may mean that they don't go and they end up going in the workforce. But we have to welcome and celebrate and enable all of that.
Right.
And I think that's Pockin's point, right?
The coordinating board is big on sort of college for all Texans, but they don't mean universities for all Texans. They mean just higher education.
For one thing, we don't have room for everybody, right. right?
Well, there's the internet now.
But a lot of these campuses are maxed out from an admission standpoint, right?
Not online, they're not.
Not online, they're not.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Senate race.
Well, now we're to billionaires from out of state, right? Where do you start with this thing?
I'll see your Peter Thiel and raise you Arthur Finkelstein. You know, that's what's happening at the moment. What's happening is that Cruz and Dewhurst are taking swings at each other. This is like now turned into Rocky IV.
Dan Patrick.
One of the bad sequels. Well, that's a separate.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think there's two phases
He's
here.
Kind of the Apollo Creed of this of the Senate race. Actually in the fight, but he's on the sidelines.
I'm starting to think part of our post-game analysis is going to be the long runoff season. And you know, when you came out of May 29th, Cruz clearly had the momentum in this thing. And then you sort of bump along through the month of June, right. and now you get to the 4th of July, and it's a dead week. Nothing really is going on in terms of politics this week. They had their fundraising deadline last week. You can't really get voters' attention this week. And they'll start again in earnest, I would imagine, next Monday on the 7th, I think that is, whatever that is. And then we start this rush toward the Olympics on July 31st. And I think that that time between May 29th and July 31st probably accrues to Dewhurst's advantage because he potentially broke Cruz's momentum.
Had the runoff been May 31st as right. opposed to July 31st, it would have been better for Cruz than it is now.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say it's not competitive. I think it is competitive all the way out. And, you know, but I just think that they're in this mode where they're both trying to get some traction. They're both trying to figure out who the voters are going to be. And they're both trying to keep people's attention at a time when people don't care about this and aren't really wanting to pay attention. Only 1.4 million people voted the first round. Probably 800,000-900,000 vote the second round. It's hard. They're trying to figure out who they are.
Boy, that's optimistic.
What do they do?
Well, you guys sort of just passed over that Dan Patrick thing. I thought that was sort of interesting, actually.
Well, we can go back to it. That's fine. So Patrick and Cruz
goes
had
up
a
Patrick's.
Thing.
Yeah.
a tryst.
Not exactly. No,
but it was scintillating.
Heresy.
Yeah. They got into a thing, and on Patrick Radio Show, and it was an angry thing, right? They had sort of a fight. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
This is like one of those family conversations. We're not going to talk about the thing, but
Cruz went on. Patrick, he said something, and Patrick instantly challenged him, saying that he didn't really understand how the Senate worked.
Right.
And then the Dewhurst campaign pushed that out as a Ted Cruz meltdown.
Right.
Mark Minor, you know, christening Ted Cruz Short Fuse Cruz.
Yeah, this is the
That's
guy
who- the Minor magic, right?
I mean, you could, from the exchange, though, you could, Short Fuse Patrick doesn't sound...
This is the guy who coined K bailout, right?
Mark Minor did.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Cruz has two one-syllable names. It's a little unfortunate for him, and they rhyme well.
You know, the issue Ted there, I mean, if there is an issue at all, is that Cruz is getting some dissonance from within the conservative wing of the Republican Party. You know, and you know, if anybody's following Patrick and wanting to vote for Cruz, if they were listening to that show, I mean, this is I'm diminishing this audience every time I put in a new clause, but if they listened to that show or heard it on the internet, and they're Patrick people, and Patrick is clearly not with Cruz. That can't
Patrick,
be helping Cruz,
if Patrick
right.
is your Pied Piper.
Now, one of the things they argued about was Cruz said, you know, well, Patrick, you've endorsed Dewhurst. And Patrick said, no, I haven't endorsed Dewhurst. But I would, you know.
Well, he's not officially endorsed Dewhurst.
He's done everything but.
Which we know because Iman and I and others here have been talking about, well, when is Patrick going to endorse Dewhurst? Because we believed he would endorse Dewhurst. And we are essentially in the on-deck circle waiting to report that the minute it happened.
Right.
And it hasn't happened. And in fact, we thought by now that it would have happened and began to wonder, well, why hasn't it happened? What does that say about Patrick's support for Dewhurst? Does it mean it's shallow? Has he changed? What's going on?
He doesn't sound like a guy who's going to go into the booth and vote for Cruz.
He doesn't. And, you know, the cynical view of this is Patrick doesn't want to enable Cruz's celebrity because that diminishes from his own, Dan Patrick's, celebrity and stroke with the Tea Party. He wants to be the Pied Piper of that particular army.
And if you want to be, you know, sort of Machiavellian about this, you know, it doesn't do any advancing senator any good to have a lieutenant governor still in your way after November.
And pissed.
Yeah, and pissed off. They'd like for Dewhurst to move on so that they can elect a new lieutenant governor and everybody can move up and, you know, climb the food chain. If Dewhurst loses this election, the interest of some number of the 31 senators is, dang, I could have been a lieutenant governor. Right? And Patrick's been one of those who said, you know, I wouldn't not want this job. Right?
And does it matter who Cruz's donors are? That was the story today in the Tribune.
It does if there's dissonance between what the candidate is saying and what the donors have been saying. You know, if you've got a candidate who is, you know, pro-gambling and all of his donors are anti-gambling, you have to ask the question, what's going on there? The question here is that Cruz is presumably anti-legalized marijuana and...
Not presumably anything. I would say I'm willing to bet that that's definitely the case. And anti-same-sex marriage.
Right. And...
his largest or one of his largest donors is both pro... Well, it was several hundred thousand dollars in the Attorney General's race a couple years ago. It was the max out in the federal contribution this time. And $1 million to the super PAC that the Club for Growth is using to finance the Cruz campaign and other campaigns.
Right.
And is it true that Dewhurst has accepted money in the past from people whose positions disagree with his own? Absolutely. I think the other part of this, though, is that Cruz has talked about how his campaign is fueled by small donors, conservative donors, and that Dewhurst is the one who's getting, you know, from himself and from others the large checks. And in fact, Cruz is obviously playing that same game or feeding at the same trough himself.
Do you want a little bit of a Peter Thiel trivia?
Yes.
Sure, why not?
He was played by Wallace Langham in The Social Network.
Yes.
Who is from which show that you particularly
Larry
like?
Sanders. Oh, please. Lay up. Kate, you a big Larry Sanders fan?
Another show I haven't heard of.
Another. The other one being The Andy Griffith Show, which I think, if you'd like to write in about how absurd that is, the
honestly,
email.
Honestly, if Kate whistles the Andy Griffith theme song successfully right now.
Oh, that would be scintillating.
It would, and I would record it, and I would make it my ringtone.
Heretical.
I don't know the conjugations of the word are allowed.
So, like I said, if you would like to complain about Kate's lack of
knowledge
television
of
cultural
culture,
awareness.
Right. Or complain about Reeves' knowledge.
Yeah, excessive knowledge.
If you'd like to know more about Wallace Langham's IMDb page, or if you have questions.
He was great
comments.
On Larry Sanders.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone was.
Yeah. Ross, you a big Larry Sanders fan?
I am.
Okay, then.
There you have it.
The address is tribcast@texastribune.org.
We should get Jeffrey Tambor to do the intro at some point.
He actually did. He did Vandepute's intro just in her voice.
He did?
Is that good?
Did I detect a hey now at the end of it, actually? I'm not sure that I did.
Yeah. On behalf of Evan.
End this thing right now.
And Kate. And Ross. And Todd, our producer. This is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Todd's particle. That would be funny, actually. All those people who tweet that Kate's stories are too serious can now shut the hell up.